Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 72-year-old monthly of political analysis, cultural criticism, and overall intellectual probity from a conservative perspective. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe for $19.95 for a digital subscription, while $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Okay, we got a lot to talk about, and we don't have much time, so we could just jump in by pointing out that the nightmare scenario of the French first round of the French elections that might have led to the National Front winning the election or prevailing significantly in the election, such that this very problematic extremist party might actually end up with the presidency in the hands of Marine Le Pen did not take place, and it appears that the Emmanuel Macron, a never elected industrialist, hedge fund banker guy, is probably going to be the next president. He is not was not a candidate of one of the two major parties that have dominated French politics since the origin of the Fifth Republic in the late 1950s. So this is a very significant result that both the socialist and the conservative parties are not going to have control of the country for the next some odd years, it appears. It strikes me as remarkable that I'm sure there are some people listening to this who were offended by my description of the National Front, Marine Le Pen's party, as extremist, and that its victory might possibly be a nightmare scenario, because over the last couple of months there seems to have been a bizarre softening of attitude among American conservatives who want to treat Le Pen, including, by the way, by the President of the United States, as though she were some kind of proto-Trump, and so Trump fans looked at her and seemed to think that she was maybe a sort of French Trump, whereas in fact she is a Putin apologist and somebody who is literally, you know, the recipient of direct support from Vladimir Putin, and is the daughter of a man who sort of deserves to have been called a neo-Nazi, whose party this was, and who
doesn't have a conservative bone in her body.
Right.
No, we're not talking about a conservative platform.
Yeah, she's a statist. She's a nationalist. She opposes standard issue international agreements, and basically the party is an unsavory collection of attitudes about race, nationalism, and Judaism that should be of deep offense to any civilized person, despite the fact that the president said she was really strong on borders, which I was unaware was a particular issue with the French, who, you know, in general seem perfectly strong on their borders, no matter what party they're in. An understanding of French national pride is not a problem for anybody in France, whether they're socialists or anti-socialists, I think. But nonetheless, here we are. So I just want to posit to you guys the idea that this presumption that there is an international worldwide movement toward Trumpism is yet to be demonstrated by the Dutch election, by the French election. There seems to have been an effort to imagine that Brexit, which of course the election for which was 5 months before the American election, was some kind of prediction of Trumpism, whereas in fact the United Kingdom was pretty steadfastly opposed to membership in the European Union from the time the European Union was first proposed. And had there been a referendum on England's entry into the European Union, it would have lost. And that such a thing did not happen before the Maastricht Treaty was signed by the British in 1993. So, I don't think that qualifies either.
There's a pretty human impulse, I guess, to make sense of things by applying them to your own unique circumstances. But it's very overly simplistic and chauvinistic to see the French election, or any election for that matter, or referenda outside the United States, as a proxy for support for Trump. It's just a ridiculous proposition. These have completely unique characteristics. And the French election in particular had absolutely nothing to do with any of the conditions that brought Donald Trump to power. What we see in the headlines in the United States are events of terrorism in France. But those didn't seem to be the unique factors on which this particular race churned.
Not in fact at all. The polling, the French attack on the police officers in the week before the election seems to have had either no effect or might actually have pushed a couple of people away from Le Pen, oddly enough. I mean, she ended up on the low end of her polling number at around 21%, whereas Macron ended up on the very high end of his polling number at around 25%.
I actually think it has a bit to do with how we define Trumpism. I mean, if we talk about Trumpism as forward-leaning nationalism, an angry populist campaign in and of itself, then yeah, I think you're right. But if we talk about Trumpism as a kind of frustration with the status quo and a sort of restlessness almost among populations to sort of change things, whatever that means to them, I think it's a very sort of amorphous idea even among voters. And I think there's a case to be made. Including in the French election, because as you say, both the socialists and the far right were sidelined.
We were talking about this in the back office, and that sort of seems like the through line if you could make one, but it's a very roundabout way to suggest that. I mean, there's a certain contingency in American political commentary that's not unique to the United States that is very frustrated with the status quo and resentful of political elites and the institutions to which they belong and have shepherded, and wants to see them destroyed or at least shaken up a lot. And to the extent that Marine Le Pen or Brexit or Trump or any of Geert Wilders or however many people represent threats to that institutional status quo, then they are welcomed by these individuals who are sort of restless.
However, you could make the case that Emmanuel Macron himself is actually a representative of the same forces. It's just that, you know, Trump and his nationalist people didn't seem to know enough about what was going on to pay attention to this. I mean, he is a guy who has never been elected to office, whose main qualification was that he left the government of socialist François Hollande on the grounds that it was too left-wing, that he was a deregulatory force in that government, and that he knows about business in a way that other people do not, because he went into investment banking and made an enormous deal, Trumpian deal, to sell a baby food company to Nestle, which netted him some enormous amount of money, like $20 million or $40 million or something like that. He's an oddball. He's married to his high school teacher, who's 24 years his senior.
That's just French politics. Yeah. You know, they always have interesting love lives.
Yeah, well, they do. It's true. I mean, there's, of course, right now doesn't seem to have a mistress, which makes him different, though we don't know. But, I mean, usually there's the wife and the mistress, you know,
yes.
who go to the funeral together, you know, when the political leader dies. But, I mean, you could easily have made the case that Macron, who wants to deregulate and modernize the French economy, himself is an enemy of the status quo, since he invented a new political force to win the election, you know,
but he's a globalist because he's not hostile towards these supranational institutions that have become the subject of so much consternation for the populist right.
Yeah. Now, I mean, from what I gather, and I'm not really an expert on this, but from what I gather, he's sort of one of these guys. He is sort of like a Davos man. You know, he loves TED Talks, and he's, you know, he has the holograms. And I mean, I don't know all that stuff, and that he's kind of like a postmodern political figure. And either will take a serious look at deregulating the French economy, which France very much needs. It's a ridiculously, and always has been, a ridiculously overregulated economy. If we think that Brussels imposes absurd restrictions and regulations on Europe, you know, from its central position as the governing force of the European Union. I mean, in France, you know, if you own a piece of property, the government can tell you what you can and can't grow on it. You know, if you want to grow a certain kind of grape outside of the region in which the grape is grown, you're not allowed to. You'll be arrested, or you'll burn your vineyard down, or something like that. So, you know, this is not an understanding of private property as we see it in the United States, and it's a very, you know, very serious business. So, all I'm saying is that the notion that people are frustrated with politics is clearly very true, and that people all over the world are frustrated with politics. But big deal. So people are frustrated with politics. That doesn't mean that you then automatically assume that every action that takes place by people who are frustrated about politics has the same root in the same place in the same way, and that represents a form of, you know, the disintegration of all, either the disintegration of rational standards or the introduction of new radical populist standards. It matters what the ideas are that undergird it. And if in fact the French election, we go into the French election runoff with Macron 30-35 points ahead of Marine Le Pen, this means that the notion that Trump is leading a worldwide movement in this strange pro-Putin, anti-globalist direction, like being a supporter of Putin's or a friend of Putin's doesn't make you a globalist. It just makes you a globalist in the wrong direction.
Matt Drudge is beside himself today.
He is. Why? What is Matt Drudge saying?
I'm quoting.
Yes.
Macron, flying cars, Maddow number one in TV news, welcome to hell.
Maddow is number one. Rachel Maddow hit number one.
I don't know. Apparently, I don't follow cable news ratings anymore. I mean, it makes sense because that's the side of the ledger that's energized.
Exactly. Well, it's not the only side of the ledger that's energized. I mean, I do think
they can follow really ponderously
solipsistic.
Thank you. Monologues, yes, that don't get to the point until you're scooped.
Right. Well, here's what I would say. And we can then move this into our next topic, which is a discussion of Trump's first 100 days. That it has been remarked all over the place that there is a new engagement with political news in the United States, right? I mean, we've had commentaries, had a surge of attention, subscriptions, 20% gain in 4 or 5 months. New York Times, you know, sort of record cable ratings all over the ideological map, from Fox on the right to CNN in the center left to MSNBC on the left, publications, television. Why is this? So here's my presumption. My presumption is that there was actually a flattening of affect in relation to news from 2011 onward, and maybe really from 2012 onward, when it became clear that we were in a period of policy stagnation, the likes of which I don't think we have ever seen, right? I mean, no major piece of legislation passed the Congress in the last 6.5 years. You know, the only thing that ever happened were unilateral presidential actions in foreign policy, droning, stuff that went on in Libya, failure to do things in Syria, the Iran deal. Stuff that, you know, irritated and annoyed the right and kind of pleased liberals, and the left was not very happy. But basically, the ideological conduct thing was a kind of was like a trench warfare frozen battle, right? In which everyone was in their trenches and no one was fighting because it was just attrition and nothing was going to happen. So Trump comes along, Hillary Clinton, Trump comes along, and now all the battlements we're now in a new, everything is in a new order. And we have no, we don't understand it. Nobody gets it. Nobody understands what the order of battle is, who's going to fight who, who's on this line, who's on that line. And that's interesting, and it's unexpected. And anyone who's interested in the future of the country and the present condition of the country is going to want to read and pay attention to what's going on, because, you know, there's a lot of drama. We don't know who is on the Republican side, who's dominating in the White House, what's going to happen with the Democrats, and the general ideological battle between left and right and between Democrat and Republican is just it's unclear. And when else does one pay attention to news but when you don't understand what's going on and need the facts?
And I would add that during the sort of official policy standoff, the politicization of the culture did not stop. The American people were very politicized, almost overly politicized. And so by the time the election hit, it was ripe. It brought all that to a head.
You could almost imagine that the two are in a kind of seesaw relationship. So if politics, which is where politics is supposed to take place, freezes, then everyday life and the cultural order of the nation, which is not where politics is supposed to take place, becomes politicized because
it's the outlet.
Tribal distinctions are no longer so clear.
Right. So you had a president who was unwilling or unable to figure out any way to make common, to move the ball forward in terms of finding some common ground with some Republicans, and Republicans who were equally dug in to simply destroy the president and, you know, make him as ineffectual as possible because he had done way too much when he had a gigantic majority in Congress to help him and had spent $2.5 trillion and had passed legislation of very far-reaching effect without any input, you know, just simply from a Democratic perspective. So,
well, it's not like the debates over policy were any less acrid or passionate.
They were totally acrid, but they were pointless. Right. I mean, everything became a secondary battle. So you had battles over the shutdown of the government, which were actually battles over policy.
Actual legislation in the 111th Congress. We have to go back that far to actually think of really serious legislation.
Right. But the Democrats could pass legislation at will, and they had a Democratic president who could sign it at will. So now we have the first 100 days of Trump. And, of course, the great story of the first 100 days of Trump was that nothing got done. I mean, Gorsuch was nominated, but anyone would have been nominated, right? I mean, open seat, and so someone would have been picked, and hearings would have been held, and that would have happened.
Well, can we stop right there and examine that? Because conservatives are gonna balk at that and say, well, this is a really big accomplishment. It's one that would not have happened if Hillary Clinton were elected. And it's one of the things that people who were opposed to quote-unquote never-Trumpers in the campaign hammer first and foremost, Gorsuch, fall on your knees and thank Trump for Gorsuch.
Okay, fair enough.
And you're going to make this point too, and it's absolutely true. And to the extent that he read this off a list and it's a really good pick, it is a really good pick. And it got confirmed, but it's not like this was a cost-free proposition. The rules of the Senate had to be changed for nominees. That is not something that's ever going to go back. That's something Republicans will regret, if not today, then the next day. And all this was done in order to maintain the status quo. We just maintained the ideological balance on the court, status quo ante, the death of Antonin Scalia. Conservatives did not move the ball forward here. This is all lateral.
Yeah. And ultimately, you have to say that if you really think that this was a fantastic strategic victory, the person who deserves credit for it is Mitch McConnell and not Trump. Because McConnell, very lethargically and stoically and with utter calm, prevented Merrick Garland from having a hearing and kept the seat open. Basically it was a jump ball. I mean, so Garland didn't get a hearing, and if Hillary had won, she would have gotten her guy through and whoever it was, and Trump got his guy through. And yes, so Gorsuch is a good pick. I'm just saying that anyone probably would have been a perfectly good pick. And so that's the virtue of Trump's election. That's not the virtue of Trump's governance, okay? I mean, it's a virtue of Trump's heart because he didn't pick his sister and he didn't pick, Alex Jones to be on the Supreme Court so that it would have challenged you know, the legitimacy of any such decision. But
yeah, so this is a good thing. It's not something that we're, you know, poo-pooing. It's a value and a benefit. But what there has been no real conservative movement in legislation or reform of anything that's permanent. I mean, we've seen Barack Obama appeal to, I'm sorry, Donald Trump appeal to Barack Obama's pen and phone strategy, which he's just basically undoing all that Barack Obama did with the stroke of a pen,
right,
to the extent that he can. And Donald Trump's successor will do precisely the same thing. This is written in sand.
Yeah, I mean, when the last paragraph, I believe, or it's one of the last paragraphs of my book, Hell of a Ride, which was written in 1993, points out that Bill Clinton came into office, and as George H.W. Bush was taking off in the plane to leave Washington, after leaving, Bill Clinton voided all of his executive orders, because that's what you can do as president. And one of the problems with the pen and phone strategy of Barack Obama in passing executive orders is that it was actually quite ineffectual. I mean, not only did the orders that we hadn't even really heard of or paid that much attention to, ones involving certain declarations of stuff for the EPA and the CDC and other things, which were simply voided as a matter of deregulatory effect by the Trump agency, but the ones that he really, you know, suffered over, right, or like had, you know, the Dreamer thing and some other things, like, court stopped them. So that's the other thing, is that they're not, we talk about it as though it's, you know, an unconstitutional arrogation of authority to the president. But the fact is that it's not one of the three co-equal branches of government appealed to, stopped the imposition of various executive orders of Barack Obama's, stopped over the course of his presidency various assertions of executive power to appoint people who were not, you know, to certain jobs that they should not have been appointed to because of the separation of powers problem. And here's Trump. He two drafts of the executive order on immigration, and they're both stayed.
Well, one thing that you had just mentioned, which I think is not correct, is you had said DACA, which is still on the books. DACA is the Deferred Action Deportation of Children.
Right.
Of it, and that's actually a really important point, because executive actions that are made in service to some sort of a social good or something that's viewed as economically critical, like Donald Trump could pass a deregulatory executive action, which a Democrat will run on repealing and won't, because the effect of it would be too draconian. And that's sort of what happened with DACA. DACA is probably never going away, even though it'll never be law, just because to really repeal that through enforcement would be such a terrible set of headlines for this White House that I can't imagine they would ever do that. So it just depends on what kind of headlines you're going to incur. And that's where we're at for governance. We're governing by press.
Well, right. But that is really, I mean, that's what most characterizes the first 100 days. It's not policy, but it's process. It's the ineptness. I mean, it's sort of, that's the story. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of sort of mythical silliness around first 100 days in general. But I would say in Trump's case in particular, it actually is more meaningful, because who gets the sense that anything, that his days going forward are going to be any different? I mean, I think it's sort of, he really sort of laid out the problems with this administration.
Reading this long interview that he gave with the Associated Press's Julie Pace this weekend on the subject of the first 100 days and various other things, one is hard-pressed to look at Trump himself, not his administration, but Trump himself and his own view of what has happened, and think that what we're talking about, and I know people are going to start getting angry at me again because I'm not being nice and I should be nice and he's trying and all this, is that he is the first unserious president that we've had in my lifetime. I'm just turned 56, so, you know, that means from Kennedy onward. He's not a serious person. His view of the job of president is not serious. There's no consistency of purpose. He talks a lot about his polls. He talks about a lot of what he's seeing on TV. When asked about the evolution of his views on NATO. He said openly, when I said that NATO was obsolete, I didn't really understand what it was, and now I'm getting a better sense of it. So maybe it's not obsolete, but what do I know? I mean, you know, I predicted a lot of terrorist attacks. And when NATO started, you know, terrorism wasn't on the agenda. Now it's on the agenda. So he says this all together in one statement, and it's like listening to the ramblings of a guy giving an after-dinner speech who had three scotches and doesn't know what the subject of the paragraph was that he started speaking. We have been attempting from the beginning to impose an overarching order on Trumpism, and there are magazines starting out with this, and Steve Bannon is trying to spell it out, and Byron York at the Washington Examiner is trying to figure it out, and various people, Ben Domenech at the Federalist is trying to figure it out, and you cannot impose order on chaos. Chaos is just chaos. This is not a serious person. He doesn't view what he is doing in any kind of overarching context. He doesn't have preceding ideas. He doesn't have a policy basis on which he wants to take those ideas and put them into practice. We had the spectacle this week of him saying that there was going to be a tax bill, a tax plan was going to be released when there is no tax plan, and that they would vote on health care this week, which Paul Ryan said they're not going to do. Because there's no difference to Trump, it appears, between announcing that you have a tax plan and having a tax plan.
You might risk, I mean, credibility aside, you might risk by trying to call this entropic process something else and, you know, graft onto it meaning and purpose and broader, grander scale than it really is. You might miss what's actually happening, which is sort of this decoupling of the White House and credibility. Like, the Speaker of the House just basically said, don't listen to the White House. The White House doesn't know what it's talking about. That's remarkable. That's crazy. That's the sort of stuff that doesn't normally happen. And we're not talking about it because to do so is to admit that what we're seeing is unpredictable. And not unpredictable in a good way. Like unpredictable in a runaway train kind of way.
Well, look at what happened after the strike on Syria, right? So the week after, we and other people and everybody writing about this said, look, this could be a real moment of, you know, a moment at which the presidency begins in earnest because we, you know, did something. It was isolated, contained, but it might have had a message for North Korea, and it might be this, and we're gonna, Syrians will do that, and he's proven that he's unpredictable, and that he'll act quickly, and he's not gonna like sit and tear his hair out and all this. And his behavior since has made it clear. It's almost as though he's saying to us, don't take me seriously. What I did on Syria was not serious. I just like saw some pictures of beautiful children dead, and I figured I needed to do something, and now I'm done, and now I'm back sitting for 3 hours watching Morning Joe and complaining about some unnamed person's hairstyle and clothing, who I hope is not me. I mean, it might be. I think I look perfectly fine, and my, you know, I think I look relatively groomed, but it could be me. They didn't say in the New York Times, didn't say in Politico who it was that he called Joe Scarborough to complain about, but you know, I figure it's probably not me. It's probably you know, this guy Gerardus, who I was on with once, who has a big head of hair, but I could be wrong. But I mean, if that's why he's, it's probably, it could be me because I wasn't invited to the meeting of conservatives at the White House today. I would not be a favorite in the Trump White House, but
a meeting of conservatives in the White House would be a rather hostile gathering.
Well, you know, conservatives, Breitbart, some other people. So that's anyway.
But
I think I'm relatively well groomed.
No, I would hope that it's you so that you stick in the president's craw because you know right. You'd rather be remembered poorly than not be remembered at all.
Oh, thanks very much. I think I'm not remembered at all, but that's okay.
The impossible situation here, though, is that so Trump is an unserious person dealing every day in the most serious matters. I mean, so watching him, you still have to derive some meaning from it. It's not even just a human impulse. He's affecting very serious things.
Why do you have to, though? That's giving us a false negative here. We're getting bad results because we're seeking from these experiments that aren't there.
Okay, so Being There was a novel by Jerzy Kaczynski, which was turned into a movie with Peter Sellers, directed by Hal Ashby in 1979, in which a simpleton gardener wanders into American politics and says, totally gnomish and straight on things about gardening, and everyone takes them to be metaphors about American life, and he sort of ends up as a presidential candidate. So Trump is obviously not Chauncey the Gardener from Being There, because he's much too aggressive and, obviously uses hostility and rage and open anger and all of that as a weapon, whereas Chauncey Gardner's just a cipher. But in that sense, what's going on is he says things like, we need water for the plants to grow. And people go, see, he's talking about the importation tax. That's how it could be like Being There somehow.
Well, yeah, but it's also like Being There in that just circumstantially, whether or not he's serious, he has everything he affects is serious, and there are serious consequences to his unserious actions.
I think we would have a much better presidency if the people the president listens to weren't trying to create for him an alternate reality in which he's super effective and a really good president. We would get a much more introspective, because he's not a really deep thinker, but he's not completely oblivious to the world around him. He does consume this material, particularly people who he respects and likes, who usually write good things about him. That sort of incentive structure has created a proliferation of people who say good things about him. But that doesn't mean he's completely ignorant of criticism about him, and he reflects on and seems to react to and change his behavior as a result of those criticisms. So people who are feting Donald Trump in a way that he doesn't deserve are doing him no favors.
Well, I mean, you never do anybody favors except if you're trying to brown nose somebody by saying what he wants to hear, which is that you're doing just great and it's absolutely fantastic.
But we would get a better class of commentary and maybe a better presidency if people were no longer trying to impose their vision on this thing because they really, really want the elites to suffer a little bit.
I mean, look, who doesn't want the elites to suffer a little bit? The elites in America deserve to suffer. Like, they're foolish. They come up with foolish ideas about what's going on. Elite college campuses have become, nests of anti-intellectual hostility toward, ideas that are deemed unconventional. Liberal shibboleths don't tell us very much. Conservative policy solutions that date back to Ronald Reagan don't really speak to to the problems of our time. They're just sort of the same application of the same poultice on the same wounds. And so it's good that elites suffer and feel insecure. And that's where we get back to this notion that, something new is going on in America that nobody yet understands, and Trump himself doesn't understand it. And we are all attempting to impose, priors to make some sense out of it. And it can be that there is no sense to be made out of it, and that the sense we have of it will only happen in retrospect. If Trump is so as reactive as you suggest, Noah, then it will be his reactions that will tell us something about what matters and what doesn't matter over the next 4 years. Because we'll know what hits him that he has to react to, right? I mean, the thing is that he may well be totally unmoved by the challenges to cultural orthodoxy that were so exciting and thrilling to Obama, or the Obamans, the notion that we're progressively leading America in a wonderful direction to the future by advancing bathroom laws and by going after bakers and by going after, people who have to sign wedding contracts and all that sort of thing. And that he just won't care about any of that. And so that's not what he'll react to. What he'll react to is the idea that he's failing or that he doesn't know what he's doing or that, there's no future for him in, his incompetence is going to render him impotent.
That's something we should speak to too, because in the pre-show meeting, peeling back the curtain.
Oh, so exciting! There was a pre-show meeting.
We did discuss presidential visions for the country, and to the extent that we can identify a vision for the future of the United States of America in 4 or 8 years that exists in Donald Trump's head, it's one in which Donald Trump is really well liked, but there's not much substantive that he wants to accomplish. We can't think of a presidency that is less focused on some sort of a concrete achievement beyond Donald Trump wants the country to be successful and prosperous. But that's sort of vague. Like, there's not really any significant reform, a place that he wants the country to be in.
To give you an example, before 9/11, George W. Bush said he was going to be the education president, right? And so he devoted the first 6 or 7 months of his presidency to the advancement of the No Child Left Behind Act, working with Teddy Kennedy across the aisle to get this thing through the Senate, right? And a lot of people on the right hate No Child Left Behind and think it was a failure and all of that. Fine. But if you voted for Bush, and even if you didn't vote for Bush, you knew in the absence, you know, after before 9/11, you knew that his presidency was going to be about doing some tax cuts and education reform. Right. All we know about Trump is that he wants to make America great again, and that he said he was going to build the wall, and that he was, what else? Going to stop, find out what the hell was going on and stop immigration from Muslim countries or something like that. Beyond that, it's very hard to say. NAFTA was a bad deal. Iran was a bad deal. So, but that doesn't tell you what he would want to do in their place. That's part of the problem with the news that came out about how he was affirming that the Iran deal was still within, you know, he let it go through for another 6 months based on the deal that Congress passed, right? Which is, and then everyone is now trying to say, you see, but he did it, but you see in the letter that was written, you can see the contours of how he's going to get out of the Iran deal. He's putting him on notice, he's going to do this, he's going to do that, he's going to do the other thing. Fine. But you can't just get out of the Iran deal. Getting out of the Iran deal requires you to have an incredibly detailed set of policy prescriptions to do what comes after. How are you going to prevent them from getting a bomb? You're back to the status quo ante.
Here's the fascinating thing to me is that I agree that I think his main motivation is to be liked. But even in going about that, he doesn't do that in a sort of standard politician way. His interest in wanting to be liked does not lead him to sort of poll-tested policies. You know, he's not sort of like a Hillary in that way, you know, making sure that he's sort of in keeping with the times. He doesn't – it's more of a sort of entertainment industry approach to being liked. I'm gonna say things and do things and appear in places and ways to try to get people to like me when they don't like me. And that's completely different.
Now, I think it's worth saying that since we've been spending the last 15 minutes talking negatively about this, that the Democratic Party is in horrendous condition. I mean, we should not then presume and look at this and say, boy, the Democrat, he's doing badly, so the Democrats are, you know, are just sort of in peachy keen condition. You have Tom Perez, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, declaring this weekend that no candidate who will get support from the party can have a view that is anything but pro-choice on abortion.
That didn't come out of the blue either.
No. It's deranged. It is deranged. It was only 10 years ago that Rahm Emanuel secured a congressional majority in the House for Democrats by running across the country pro-life candidates in House races, including Mirabile Dictu, one young woman from upstate New York named Kirsten Gillibrand, who was pro-life and pro-gun at the time. She is now neither, but, you know, so what? I mean, they won 31 seats in 2006 by running candidates appropriate for districts who did not have conventional orthodox, democratic, liberal, urban Morning Joe, more like Rachel Maddow views. If they're going to win in 2018, candidates have to be able to reflect the views of the districts that they're in. And I think it's probably fair to say that somewhere between 25 and 40% of the Democratic Party is probably functionally pro-life, just as 25 to 40% of the Republican Party is functionally pro-choice. something like that. And therefore, it's about a 45 to 10 proposition, whether or not you're pro-choice or pro-life in the United States.
Because that came about as a result of the fact that there is a somewhat pro-life candidate who's running for a special election, and Bernie Sanders was asked about him, whether or not he was progressive enough, and Bernie Sanders withheld his judgment on that one.
Right. But Nancy Pelosi, who is, you know, as orthodox as you get, said on television on Sunday in response to this, of course you can be pro-life and be a Democrat. You can't declare that people who have a view that is held by more than 40% of the American people cannot run for office in a given party. That's insane. And if the guy who's running the party is going to hold that position, the Democratic Party is not going to do very well. This is nuts.
You were just saying that there's not really a lot of interest in the cultural battles from this presidency. He's just kind of wants to change the structure of the country, literally foundationally the structure, actually infrastructure. That's about all he wants to do. But there is only interest in the cultural battles on the left. They have no real prescriptions for anything resembling a truly foundational economic reform, all that was accomplished in the 111th Congress, as we said before. And now it's just exclusively about ginning up enthusiasm among the base and the donor class with culture wars.
Right, but they have to win in these districts. They have to be able to win.
But their interest now is in raising money and getting people in the streets.
Right, fair enough. Okay, and by the way, that is important and that is necessary. And they have all of the individual qualities that are necessary for there to be a wave election in their favor in 2018, assuming that the Trump remains around where he is and the Republicans remain as unpopular as they are, except if they alienate actual voters and mistake the crowds in the street for ordinary people who actually turn out to the polls in midterm elections, which have not favored them except for 2006. I mean, 2006 was a great midterm election for Democrats. They have not had a good midterm election. They did not have any other good midterm elections over the last 20 years except for 2006. And why? Because they had some understanding that they needed to match candidates to districts in which they could win. And if that is not what's going on now, because the donor class is now in such control, the Democratic donor class is in such control of the party, then they're not going to get very far. Last topic. Big story in the New York Times this weekend, a year-long TikTok, as we call them, on James Comey, the FBI director, and his behavior, his decisions, to how he handled the Hillary Clinton case before and just, you know, before the election. So we have a big dispute here because having read the story and having thought this at the time, it is my view that Comey is a disastrous public official, that he arrogated to himself the responsibility for a unitary responsibility for figuring out what the American people should or should not know and what it should be informed of in order to protect the integrity and honesty of his agency, as opposed to abiding by a very simple proposition, which is that unless somebody is charged with a crime, investigations should neither be public, although this had already become public, or that whatever the deliberations were and whatever the findings of fact were in the case should not be exposed to public view. And rather than doing that, he decided on July 5th to give a press conference in which he basically indicted Hillary Clinton and then said there would be no charges against her. And according to the New York Times in this story, it was the unanimous opinion of the people involved in this investigation, the unanimous opinion that the charges did not rise to indictable standard, largely because of a decision made the previous year not to indict, or 2 years earlier, not to indict CIA Director David Petraeus for his handling of classified information, but to arrange a plea deal. Because Petraeus had actually shown intent, acknowledged that he had shown intent in exposing classified information to his mistress, whereas there was no evidence to prove that Hillary had the intent to hide or mishandle classified information. And so you could not indict her for something that you had already said was okay if David Petraeus, or was not indictable if David, or, you know, was not prosecutable if David Petraeus did it because of a plea. So my assertion is that however you feel about Hillary's handling of classified information, that the FBI unanimously thought it did not have grounds to indict her, and yet he gave a press conference saying that she was willfully reckless and horrible with the information, and that this was a shocking dereliction of duty on his part and a misuse of an office in which he has investigatory powers. The only protection against the abuse of those investigatory powers is the restraint that he must show in the case of a decision not to indict. Noah thinks differently.
Well, there's, in my opinion, Democrats have done themselves no favors by ignoring the role that Loretta Lynch has played in the position in which Comey found himself.
Loretta Lynch was the Attorney General of the United States under Barack Obama and was Comey's nominal boss.
Correct. She infamously took a meeting on the tarmac with Bill Clinton while investigating Hillary Clinton. A firestorm ensued, and in addressing this firestorm, she essentially recused herself from the case. She said, I will take whatever recommendation the FBI director gives me with
and
regard...
prosecutors and yeah. Justice Department, not just
we're
him
not
personally.
Not saying him okay. personally and just him personally, but everybody, but also the FBI director who is now acting in a prosecutorial role, which is not the role of the FBI. The FBI gives evidence, creates evidence, and provides it to the Justice Department. The Justice Department says, we're going to indict or we're going to put it before a grand jury. They don't make prosecutorial recommendations. And all of a sudden, the FBI director is in charge of this case. Secondarily, the notion that this standard of justice was established for David Petraeus and just applied to Hillary Clinton ignores the myriad of individuals who are now appealing to the Hillary defense, who had simply mishandled classified information, were prosecuted and convicted because intent has nothing to do with it. If there's a Navy man in a specific case who put some information on a thumb drive that she shouldn't have, moved it from one computer to the next, and that was the extent of his offense, and he was convicted of mishandling classified information. He had no intent to do anything badly with it, but because he was negligent with this, he was convicted of mishandling classified information, and his attorneys appealed to the standard established by Hillary Clinton to appeal his conviction. So it's not as though that – I think we're just sort of glossing over a lot of these facts in order to make Democrats feel better about their conviction, their personal belief that Jim Comey in loose collusion with Moscow robbed Hillary Clinton of the election.
But, I mean, I do think that the Times piece makes clear that Comey was just way too preoccupied with the idea of the FBI and how the public perceived it and the FBI's role in the election and his ongoing responsibility to not be involved in the very things that he was completely preoccupied with. And I think it was a misstep from the start that it never went right. The second he came out and gave that first press conference, right, where he essentially built a case against Hillary, only to say there's no actual final case against Hillary, was it set off everyone on both sides and did the exact opposite of what he wanted to do, which was maintain the appearance of a good working FBI.
Now, you'll notice, by the way, that I'm not talking about the case, about the matter that consumed discussion over the weekend, which is what he should have done when it was discovered that Hillary's emails were on Anthony Weiner's computer while Weiner was being looked at and apparently is still being looked at on potential child I don't know what it is. Some questions about his relations, improper contact with a minor. He had told Jason Chaffetz, the head of the House Oversight Committee, that he would inform the House had there been any changes in the status of the investigation. And there is an argument in the piece that Comey and his deputies panicked on the grounds that should it come out, before they found out what was going on, should it have come out after the election that they had known that Hillary's emails were on Wiener's hard drive and they had not informed Congress or made a public, or they had not informed Congress, and that Hillary had won the election, but that classified information had been improperly mishandled and was on Wiener's computer that rose to an indictable offense, that they would have, that their inaction would have secured the election for Hillary Clinton, and then she would have been indicted, and that this would have been, talk about the firestorm of all firestorms, that the Bill Clinton, you know, FBI had basically decided to be silent about something that could have turned the election the other direction when she was being, you know, and as we now know, it's not so easy to indict the president, by the way, as Trump himself has since discovered.
And along the same
line, I think that's a much better case. Now, if he had said to Jason Chaffetz, "I'm not letting you know any. This is an investigation. You're not gonna know anything about what goes on in our investigations unless we indict. It's not your business." But he didn't say that.
But you've just
another bad piece of judgment, perhaps.
You just made the case for what I think is a really important thing to say in Jim Comey's defense, is that it is within the purview of somebody in his position to think about their institution, its role in history, its role in American society, and to consider it in that grand arc, in the terms of the entire existence of the country and where it fits in society. And even if that conflicts with your mission a little bit, I don't think you have any – I think you have a duty, a responsibility to think about your institution in that fashion. Because to purely focus on that decision, that one letter, as something that, you know, is just a rote part of his role as the FBI director would have possibly led him to a disastrous decision.
I don't know. I just think that there's a case to be made.
I'm not saying it would have or wouldn't have, but he had to consider those other factors.
Well, there's also, along the same lines, his concern that Russian hacking had revealed emails from Democratic officials saying things like, "Don't worry, I'm certain that Loretta Lynch won't let this case get too far." And Comey's concern was, well, if that gets out after there's no indictment against Hillary, who becomes president, then the FBI will look terrible.
And that's
it would have.
Okay.
But the document
didn't come out. Right. They didn't find it or something, right? Isn't that what it's?
Well,
said?
I don't know who wrote. I don't know. It was.
It's
weird,
very unclear in the story. But I would just like to say there's a case to be made that James Comey is a monster of egotism. That this is all about him personally. That it's all about his own personal preening virtue. That he is obsessed and consumed with his own virtue, and that this was all an obsession with protecting his own reputation. And yeah, he was put in a very, very difficult position. And ultimately, the person who was responsible for Hillary Clinton's defeat is Hillary Clinton, because she put those emails on a private server and she destroyed 50,000 of them. And we don't know what they are. And we know she got rid of them. And we don't know what we don't know. And the idea that we should presume that they were all about Chelsea's wedding is to presume something about the Clintons that you have no reason to presume fairly. I mean, we're not James Comey, and we don't have to hew to some standard according to which, you know, we can't indict because we don't know. Obviously, we can't. But, you know, if she had done the right thing and not tried to hide, as a government official, tried to hide her official emails from public view or from FOIA requests or from the archivist of the Obama administration, she would be president today, unless she was a crook. And all those emails showed crooked activity.
And so, if Loretta Lynch had not taken that meeting with the husband of somebody who was under FBI investigation and then reacted to it as though she had done something wrong and then behaved in a manner that was completely and almost unprecedented, I don't know if it might have been totally unprecedented, then the FBI director would not have had to act in an extraordinary fashion.
By the way, there's another dimension to this time story that we haven't touched on, which is that this whole idea about the different way in which Comey treated the investigation into Donald Trump and Russia, right? He didn't come out and sort of, you know, reveal there's an investigation and keep people updated on it. Now, his defense, and I think this is actually sound, is that he was talking about the Trump investigation was an ongoing investigation. He came out and discussed the end of the Clinton investigation, the sort of final end product of it. I don't know.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this whole notion goes to the idea that it's not fair that her investigation was made public, right. But his investigation, like Comey, is then supposed to be some kind of like a, you know, the scales of justice. So it's like, oh, well, I guess this lowered the bar for Hillary. So we need to do something to balance it for,
right.
For Trump by, you know, because otherwise it's sort of tilting. Now, either way, this shows that the American people or the two parties are complicit because they both nominated people in problematic legal odor. I mean, Trump was had 10,000 lawsuits against him during 2015, 2016. The Republicans nominated all the stuff with Russia, all the weirdness about Russia was going on. We knew in late 2015, early 2016, even before there was an investigation, Republicans made him the nominee anyway. And Hillary's emails were a matter of public record before she announced for the presidency. And if Barack Obama weren't a feckless, you know, narcissist, he would have done something to try to help his party get away from her and into the hands of somebody who might have not been in this position, like Joe Biden or somebody else. Instead, it was left to Bernie Sanders, a ridiculous figure, to win 22 states or something like that, and to beat her over the head. And what's more, if he hadn't, Bernie Sanders in October at the first major debate between them said he didn't care about her emails, but had basically spent his entire campaign going after the notion that she was dirty and crooked, which he only really started to do in earnest later, he might really have, I mean, maybe he would have won. It was his acceptance of the idea that it was unacceptable for any Democrat to assert that Hillary Clinton had an email problem that largely probably cost him a real chance of winning the election, of winning the nomination. So she's the one who's to blame. I'm just saying that Comey is a person who should not be viewed favorably after that story, in my view.
Yeah. I mean, why couldn't he have just, given as concerned as he was, why couldn't he just have said, okay, well, my job in this case is to conduct honest and thorough investigations, period.
Or he could have issued a memo that said, we have concluded the investigation of Hillary Clinton with a decision that we are not right. We are not bringing charges against her for the mishandling of classified information, period.
Right.
Not, she was reckless, there were seven emails, there were 70, and some get, ooh, she was, ooh, it was really bad. Like, you know, who the hell, I mean, what really gets me is like, who the hell is he? Who the hell is he to stand up and make a speech about how she doesn't handle email well? Either charge her or don't charge her. His opinion is of no value. It is of no value. His opinion, you know, either you're guilty of, if you're a prosecutor or an investigator of criminal action, either you cross the line into criminal action or not. It is not for him to interpret her behavior short of her criminality.
Can I tell you what this reminds me of? It's on a different topic, but it's related, and it's something I hate for the same reason. Uh-huh. Letter grades on restaurants in New York City. If the restaurant is found to not operate up to a legal standard of cleanliness, that's one thing. If it is, that's another. I don't want it critiqued, but okayed.
That really should be binary.
Right.
Either
right.
You can.
Exactly.
Right.
Since you don't live in New York, you should know that there are three letter grades. A, B, and C, and below C, you're closed by the health department. And as it happens, there are many people who, because these letter grades now exist, will only go into a restaurant with an A.
Right, and they're on the windows like a big Soviet sort of, you know, indication.
And it's really ugly. That's right. And it only started like 2 years ago. And restaurateurs claim that they get bad grades because they're not paying off the inspectors well enough, or they're not, you know, whatever, the investigators feel like they're being mistreated. And there have been like crazy cases where clearly, you know, first-rate restaurants are getting weird letter grades because somebody shows up and, you know, they find something on the floor and they say it's a mouse dropping, which isn't, or something like that. Anyway, so Abe has now revealed
even conceptually, that should be ridiculous. Either Either yes. this is a sanitary That's place right. to eat, or it is not.
So
shades of gray.
So either Hillary Clinton is to be charged or not.
There That's you it. Go. That's right. So you're either open or you're closed.
That's right.
Okay.
She gets a B.
So congratulations, everybody. You have now, we've gone from the high to the low, from the French election to the rating of your local Chinese takeout here in Manhattan. So we've come to the end of another endless peroration here at Commentary Magazine. For Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.